thanks to Misoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Misoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Misoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Misoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We'll talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives. But don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is the legendary makeup artist, entrepreneur, and founder of the iconic Bobbi Brown Cosmetics. It's Bobbi Brown herself.
I didn't know that I was an entrepreneur. I just knew I made shit up. Sometimes you close one door and another door opens.
Bobbi started out as a makeup artist and then casually created a few lipsticks that evolved into a global beauty empire. Since leaving her billion-dollar company in 2016, she's launched Beauty Evolution and finished her ninth book. We talked about feeling pretty, the tough choices working mothers have to make, and entrepreneurial spirit. So, here we go. Bobbi Brown, welcome to the Female Lead Podcast. It's such an honour to have you here. Today we're going to be talking about the six moments that made you. How did you find choosing them?
You know, I just kind of went for it. My assistant asked me and she said, think about it. I said, no, I got it. And I just did it. They popped into my head. And I think they make sense.
I think they do too. They all kind of link together, actually. I really enjoy thinking about them. So let's start with your moment number one, which is going to Emerson and starting basically your own major. This is a very interesting story. Can you explain what happened?
Sure. It's such a fortuitous moment in my life. I was never a classic student, and I somehow managed to graduate, you know, with okay grades in high school. Went to my first college, transferred to my second college, and then came home and announced to my mom that I didn't want to go to college. And she said, you have to go to college. She didn't, and she wanted me to go. And I said, but mom, it's really boring, and I have no idea what I want to do. And she said, okay, don't worry about what you want to do, but think about if today was your birthday, and I gave you a magic wand, and you could do anything you want, what would you want to do? And I said, well, I think I'd like to go to the department store and play with makeup. And she said, why don't you be a makeup artist? And I was like, a makeup artist? Mom, I don't want to go to beauty school. And she said, I am sure there's a school where they teach you theatrical makeup somewhere. And lo and behold, I found Emerson College, which is a small school in Boston.
Then you went there, but how did you get to create your own major? This is the thing that I just can't get my head around. Explain what happened.
Well, they did not have a makeup major. It did not exist, but they have something called an interdisciplinary major, which I have still have no idea what that means. But I flew up to see them, and literally what sold me was outdoor cafes, because I never saw outdoor cafes living in Chicago.
Right.
And I chose to go to Emerson, and they allowed me to create my own major. So with an advisor, where I sat down and took art courses and history courses, communication, speech, all sorts of things. And then I got credit by doing makeup for the film department, for the theater department. And I majored in makeup and minored in photography.
And I've read that you said that you didn't know at the time, but what you did was basically being an entrepreneur, because you learned that it was what you put into something is what you get out of it. Can you explain that lesson a bit more?
Yes, I literally poured my heart and soul into what I was doing because I was engaged and interested. So what I put into it is what I got out of it. And I also realized I didn't know the word entrepreneur, but really what it is, you know, you just make stuff up. And once you make stuff up and figure it out and try things, that's being an entrepreneur. So it has kind of led me, you know, back to the, like my natural way of working is just, oh, that sounds so interesting. Why not? Let's try it.
And what was it about makeup that gave you a passion for it?
What I've always loved about makeup is that it instantly made me feel better, personally. It made me feel better about myself. And, you know, I am someone that never felt classically beautiful growing up. I don't know many people that did, but I didn't. And I always thought my friends were prettier than I was. And I would use makeup to make myself feel prettier and look prettier. And I used to watch my mom apply her makeup. My mother was the most glamorous young woman, and she was 20 when I was born. So, you know, when she was 30, I was 10. And I used to watch this beautiful woman put makeup on, and I was amazed. She was very glamorous. I never have a glamorous bone in my body or a moment in my life.
So you just like the transformation that it could create.
I do. I like the transformation. I loved helping other people do the same. Mm-hmm. And I also, at the same time, I used to make up, you know, my brothers, my stepbrothers, as if they were in a fight. I'd bruise them. I'd turn them into old men. When I was bored, that's what I did.
So you go to Emerson, you do this self-created major, and then what happened? So then you left, and then how did you get into being a makeup artist?
Well, after I graduated college, I stayed for a year. I got an apartment with a couple of friends. I stayed for a year, and I did probably the most important thing, which is became a waitress. So I was able to pay my rent. I felt self-sufficient, and I also learned how hard it is. And I think everybody should work in a restaurant before they're allowed to eat in one, by the way, because it is a very hard profession. And then I moved to New York with my boyfriend at the time, thinking, oh, I'm just going to become a freelance makeup artist in New York and just try it. I didn't know anyone, but one day I opened up a fashion magazine and I saw an article about a makeup artist who did makeup for all the fashion shows, photographers, and I thought, wow, that's so interesting. So I wrote her a letter. She didn't answer me. When I came to New York, I called her, left a message. She didn't call me back, but she did have on her answering machine her agent. And so I called her agent and I asked if I can come in and see him. And I wanted to understand how things worked. And he pretty much told me and said, I can't represent you, but I can help you. And he helped me assist different makeup artists. And I started to build a portfolio. And again, I pounded the pavement. I picked up the yellow pages. I called people. I did free things, putting my, you know, portfolio. And one day I got a job, my first job, which was actually working for Glamour magazine. It was a story about a dancer. I lied and said I did hair as well as makeup. And this amazing photographer, Brigitte Lancôme,
wow,
the first photographer I ever worked with, was lovely and wonderful. And I made the girl up and she said, Bobby, could you also make up her feet? I remember to the day when the pictures came out of the magazine, it was one page. There was, you know, probably 20 pictures on a page, but in the little teeny corner, it said hair and makeup by Bobby Brown. I just was floored.
That was it. You made it.
I made it. Yeah.
You made it.
I got paid $150 US and I made it.
Wow. And working with Brigitte, who, for anyone listening who doesn't know, she is the photographer who did the pictures for the female lead book and is now like a legend like you. Let's go on to your point two. So the number two is meeting your husband through a mutual friend.
Mm-hmm. So, well, I dated my boyfriend that I went to college with for 12 years. So from 18 to 30, and for, you know, any girl out there, you turn 30, you break up and you're like, I'm just never going to get married. That's it. I'm going to be a career woman and that's it. And I always, my dream was always to get married and have a family. So at 30 years old, I was single, you know, literally sowed my wild oats like in a month. I won't talk about those things. And then a friend of mine said, you know, let's go out to dinner with my friend Steven. And that night I got smacked in the face. I didn't know anything about him. I just literally, like, I know it doesn't happen to everyone, but I looked at him. I got home that night and I was like, OMG, I just met the man I'm supposed to marry.
Wow.
That was it. And we were engaged in 3 months.
No way.
We were engaged in 3 months because it was actually a practical situation. I needed to renew my rent. And I told him I wouldn't live with him because I lived with the last guy. I said, I'm not doing that. And so he asked me to marry him because I didn't sign a new lease.
Right. And so how long have you been married now?
We have been married, this September will be 33 years.
Wow. So how do you feel like that relationship has shaped you, thinking about these moments as, you know, how they've brought you to where you are?
Well, it was honestly so many things that has brought me to who I am is because of circumstance. So we fell in love, we got engaged, I was coming up in my career, and I finally got my dream, which was to do makeup on a Vogue cover. So American Vogue, it was Naomi Campbell's first cover, Patrick Demarchelier shot it, and I, you know, had this Vogue cover, and I'll never forget, my husband found the cover and brought it to me in a location van one day. And it was the same day that I got a call from Ralph Lauren to spend 3 weeks in Tahiti with Bruce Weber shooting their campaign for an enormous amount of money. And my husband and I did not have money at the time. And honestly, you would think I'd be so excited and jump on it. I was panicked. I did not want to leave my husband for 3 weeks. And my husband said, you know what? It's okay to turn it down. And I turned it down. Which, you know, I still can't believe to this day I had the courage to say no to this incredible opportunity. And around that time is when I got this idea for a lipstick. So, you know, sometimes you close one door and another door opens.
It led to a life-changing moment, which was when you went, it was Kiehl's, right? You happened to go there on a shoot. And you spoke to the chemist and you said, I want to make a lipstick that looks like lips. And he did that for you. And that was the start of everything.
That was definitely the start. You know, it one lipstick, but then I realized not everyone has the same color lips. Mm. You know, as a woman and a makeup artist, I was always obsessed with natural colors in people's face. Like I look at you now and I could see the color of your lips. So I would always want to come up with a lipstick that, you know, wasn't lighter, oranger, pinker, but just literally the color of your lips. So that's how I started.
And that at the time, it's hard for people to understand, I think, because your style has been so copied and has influenced makeup so much. But at the time when this was happening, which was like late 80s, that was not what lipsticks were like, right? That the natural look was not a thing.
Right. I think this was probably, I got married in 88. So this was about 89 right now. And, you know, I created these 10 colors. 7 of them were lip colors. 3 of them, there was a red, a pink, an orange. I just started kind of visualizing in my head what all the women that I've ever met in my entire life, including models and friends and nannies, people from other, you know, places in the world. Now I know it's called a focus group, but I visualized what their lips would look like. And I realized people always think, what color lipstick should I wear for my skin color? It doesn't matter what your skin color is. It matters what your lip color is. Mm. That really affects it. So I did these 10 colors and I started selling them to friends, to models. And one day I went out to lunch with a friend of mine who happened to be the beauty editor at Glamour magazine. And we talked about, you know, I had a young child at that point. We talked about our husbands, our child. And she said, how's work? And I said, well, actually, I told her about the lipstick. And she said, oh, can I write about it? I'm like, why would you want to write about it? Now I know it's called PR. And she wrote about it in Glamour. And I started getting bombarded with phone calls. And I believe I probably had my home number on at the time. And we started selling them out of my house. My husband went back to law school. We had a baby. I was still commuting to the city to do shoots and going to the post office, you know, when these orders came in. And they got very popular that even my sister-in-law ended up coming to our house to do the books. And it did really, you know, I figured, oh, little, you know, money for dinner, grocery money. I had no vision of anything else, none.
So that is so interesting because, you know, you imagine that someone comes up with an idea and has a plan. And I think all of these podcasts that I've been doing with women who have had extraordinary lives and great success, it's not always like a vision and then a goal and going for it. It happens in a strange kind of meandering way often.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, if you are someone that is entrepreneurial, which I am, you see opportunity where other people don't. So one day, this is a true story. One day I was at a party in New York City, some, you know, Upper East Side lady's house. And a friend's brought us and I thanked her for inviting us. And, you know, she told me she was a fan of mine. She knew who I was from the magazines. And I said, oh, what do you do? She said, I'm a cosmetics buyer for Bergdorf Goodman. And I said, oh, I have these lipsticks I'm selling out of my house. And she said, wow, you should come pitch us. We'd love to have them. And so I pitched her and she said, okay, we'd love to take them. And one day I was at a shoot for another department store and I beeped into my answering machine after she told me they were taking them. She said, I'm really sorry, we don't have room. We can't do it right now. And I was crushed. So I hung up the phone. I don't even know how this came into my head, but the Saks people that I was doing a catalog with said, oh, you should tell us about it. And I said, no, 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 I'm going into Bergdorf's. I called back the lady at Bergdorf. I said, I got your message, no problem, because Saks wants it. And she said, no, we're going to take it. She did not want Saks to get it first. How I even knew to do that, I have no idea.
And later you learned that's bluffing.
Now, later I learned that's bluffing. Yes, exactly. But I just, you know, and it was true. Yes, the Saks people said, come tell us. But these were the art directors and creative directors. They weren't the decision makers. Right. So the truth is, I didn't lie. The truth is they wanted it, but I did not have a commitment from them.
That is, I mean, another great like moment of opportunity and chance.
We ended up, I guess you could call it now a relaunch. Once we got into Bergdorf, we had to, you know, scale up and we had to do things a little more professional because the lipsticks we sold originally were put in a manila envelope and with a little printout of the ingredients mailed to people. And clearly that's not going to work at Bergdorf. And, you know, the financial deal between the chemist and I could not be something that's, you know, is something that is sustainable. So we had to kind of press the reset button and do things professional. And we aligned with these two people that we met and that had more experience. And we partnered on this company.
And what's your advice for marriage? What are your tips for a good marriage for over 30 years?
Well, my biggest tip is, you know, marry well. My second tip is know what pisses the other person off and just try not to do it.
That is so good.
But it's true, you know, and be nicer. Like, honestly, it's like the older we get, I notice like we're both a little bit nicer to each other because it's, you know we're in this for the long haul. And it's not easy. I'm not an easy person to live with. He's not an easy person to live with, but who is?
Oh, yeah, completely. Yeah, that's a good tip. Just be nice, be kind.
Yeah, just be nice, be kind, and you know, and it's not, and also I learned something very valuable, since hopefully there's a lot of women listening, both working in corporate America and having a husband. When you work, when you're a strong woman and you work with a lot of men, gotta let them speak. And you have to say, oh, I hear what you're saying. That's a really interesting idea. By the way, side note, that doesn't mean I'm going to do what you tell me to. But yes, that's a brilliant, interesting idea. Thank you for sharing that.
And do you take that?
Yeah, because what's the point of fighting? Like, what is the point of fighting?
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, a very good lesson. And with other women, you know, like as well, like choose your battles, right?
Yeah, choose your battles.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the same thing when you have children. You know, what is, like, some things are not negotiable and other things are.
So much. Choose your battles. I think I say that like every week about my children. Like, yeah. So actually that brings us nicely onto your point three, which is having your three children. So you have three sons. I have two. I cannot imagine having three. Respect to you. I mean, you also had three children. Well, you didn't have three children, but you had small children while you were building your business. How did you do that?
I have no idea. I mean, honestly, like I look back now and it's so easy to say, you know, I did this and I did this. And yes, I have little hacks. Now they're called hacks that helped a lot.
Yeah.
Of course, I had the, you know, my life partner who was and still is the most incredible father. I mean, beyond. And, you know, we kind of divided what we were doing. So it was a real partnership. I always had some kind of niece or nephew, mostly nephews, you know, around for summers and vacations. So I was able to do that. We had great nannies and honestly, mannies. I hired a lot of men that were, you know, teachers in the school that come after school. We never really had live-in, I think, maybe when they were very, very young. And, you know, I don't know. It's just, you just figure it out. You just, you figure it out. And it's not easy. There was times where I didn't sleep the night before. I'd have to go on TV. My kids came down with chicken pox and I was supposed to leave for a trip to the UK to go, you know, on have one night to rest and then start doing the TV circuit. And I chose not to cancel the trip, but I literally got off the plane and went right to the TV studio because I wanted to spend when they, you know, had the high fever, I wanted to be home. So I did that. And I was, you know, you're young. Well, I was youngish. I was 41 when my baby was born. So that's not that young.
Right. And how old were you when your first child was born?
32 when my first was born and 34 with my second. And we were going to adopt a child and it just never happened. And I ended up saying, okay, I'm just gonna try. It took me a while, but I finally got pregnant with the third. And, you know, it's, I can't imagine my life without the baby. He's 22, my baby.
He's 22, right, your baby.
Yeah, my baby.
And so how do you feel, you know, thinking about how this has shaped you, how has it shaped you having your three sons?
Well, first of all, I raised my kids in Montclair, New Jersey, 12 miles from the city. So I was able to leave anything, whether it's a aggravating meeting or a, you know, fancy Met Gala, like whatever we did, and I would get to go home and kind of take off the, you know, the working Bobby and put on the comfortable Bobby, which honestly back then you wouldn't let people know that you were a soccer mom or you wore clogs or your hair was, you know, wet in a ponytail for 8 hours a day. But that's honestly who I'm most comfortable being. Now it's popular, you know, now it's being schleppy is now is stylish. So yeah. I don't know, like even early on, I tried to pretend I was whatever and I would just, I wasn't, you know, and I realized I'm much more comfortable in my skin when I am myself.
This relates to a story that I really wanted to talk to you about. And it's a story about you working. You're at a shoot with Jean-Paul Gaultier. And you've made an arrangement to have dinner with your husband and your son after the shoot. They come and collect you. And just before, Jean-Paul Gaultier is saying, come out for dinner. And then you have this choice.
Right. And a visual. I'm a very visual person.
Yeah, so I love see,
I wish I snapped a picture. So Jean-Paul Gaultier is wearing the traditional striped t-shirt that he wears. And it was Scavullo was the photographer. And it was, you know, way above my head at the time, being, you know, wanting to be liked and accepted by the, you know, the creme of la creme. And, oh, Bobby, come to dinner with us. And I was like, we didn't have cell phones back then, so I couldn't even call my husband and say, babe, do you mind? So my husband shows up, and he's this, like, absolutely gorgeous, you know, 32-year-old wearing a striped shirt. And the baby is also wearing a striped shirt. And I look out, and there is Jean-Paul Gaultier and my husband with the baby carrier wearing stripes. And I said to myself, but I said, dude, choose a door. And I chose my husband and the son. I'm like, okay. So I never had dinner with Jean-Paul Gaultier, but my husband was not mad at me. So that was worth it.
But there must have been something, it wasn't just about your husband being mad at you, right? Something deep in you was kind of choosing the family and the home part of yourself over the kind of, like you say, the sort of glamorous.
I always did. I had many times where I had to make those choices, and I chose it. I mean, another time I was invited to a friend's 40th surprise party. And I was, you know, I had a couple young kids, and I said, yes, I'd go to the surprise party. And then I get a call from Nicole Kidman to do her makeup, her and Tom Cruise, for Saturday Night Live. And I'm like, oh my God, what do I do? There was no way I could do both. And I obsessed. And I finally made the decision, no, I have to go to Gino Goldberg's 40th birthday. And I did. And I never got to do Nicole's makeup. But my life would not be changed if I did.
So that's interesting. So do you think that's partly because you're maybe not that starstruck by famous people, or is it that you're just loyal and grounded and you care about your real life?
I am absolutely starstruck by a lot of these people. Of course I am. So, you know, I've never done J-Lo's makeup. I danced next to her at a Golden Globes party, but I've never done her makeup. And I did get an opportunity, and same thing, I couldn't do it. Gwyneth Paltrow, I remember Brad Pitt has a new girlfriend, you know, but no, it was a Saturday and my husband and kids were going somewhere local skiing. So I always chose my family because, yes, I feel my best when I am grounded, and I like to be grounded.
Right. And do you think, I mean, I like you've said, a lot of women have to make these choices, and there's a lot of stuff that happens after work, you know, in the bar, you know, at a work party that you can't go to more than men because you have to go home and do the pickup. Did you feel like that held you back in any way, or do you feel like it doesn't have to hold you back? That stuff is all kind of bullshit.
I get, we get to swear on this podcast.
Yeah, we can swear.
Yay. Okay. No, I, you know, when you're doing it at the time, I'm not going to pretend that I just was very stoic and made these decisions and didn't question, but I did finally get, you know, the older I got and the more experience, yes, it was easier to make the decisions, but I always had to make choices. I always had to make choices. So I think that it didn't hold me back. It certainly made me a happier, more grounded person. And, you know, your life and your family and your health, those things are so important that a lot of women forget about. And by the way, there's other ways to get ahead than drinking with people at a bar. So, you know, I do think there's other ways. And, you know, now with our digital life, I've had, you know, I've met many people on FaceTime, you know, instead of meeting in a restaurant. And guess what? It's a 20, 30 minute and you're done.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories. Let's move on to point four. So you started this big makeup brand, which then, you know, it's Bobbi Brown Essentials, and then it exploded. And only 4 or 5 years later, around 1995, you then sell the brand. So can you tell us what happened there?
Sure. We had gotten a few calls, and I had a few lunches with, you know, either finance people or, you know, venture people or even a couple other cosmetics companies, and nothing ever came of it. We weren't for sale. We weren't looking. My husband and I had these partners. The four of us were in this together. It was not an easy relationship. And, you know, there was a lot of especially the wife and myself did not always see eye to eye, and it was a little tough. And one day I get a phone call. Actually, Frederick Fekai called me and said, "Oh, Leonard Lauder would like to meet you." And I'm like, "Okay, Leonard Lauder, sure." So we went to his house for dinner, and he said, "You're beating us in the stores. You remind me of my mother, and we'd like to buy you." And I'm like, "We're not really for sale." But he said, "What if I told you you could do what you love, and we will do all the rest? And what if I promise you complete autonomy?" I had no idea what autonomy was, but now it just means you could do what you want. And we ended up selling the company, and it was pretty amazing. It didn't change our life drastically. We still had the house we lived in, and we still had the car, but we ended up buying seats at a basketball game, like front row seats at our local basketball. And we made the decision to send all of our nieces and nephews to college. And that was how it really changed. So we have now sent about 20 kids to college.
Wow, that's amazing.
Which is what I'm most proud of, yes.
Yeah. So just talking about the business, it really was revolutionary at the time, wasn't it? And it just filled a huge gap in the market. And it was kind of a natural look, but also you were one of the first brands to really cater for all different skin tones. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, for most of the time I worked for the company, I had very hard time separating myself from the brand. Like, it was my brand. It's what I thought was right. And, you know, for most of the years, that's really what happens. So as a makeup artist, I knew what it was like to be at a shoot and not have a foundation that matches someone's skin. And none of the foundations matched the black models back then. And certainly when I launched foundations, I couldn't even imagine a woman coming to the counter and not being able to find her color. And I used to fight with my teams because they'd want to discontinue the low selling colors. And I'd say, "No, we can't. Those are people's skin colors. Go get me more black customers, you know, like market to black women." And, you know, somehow that didn't happen. But, you know, I think that when a woman finds a foundation that matches, she would tell her friends. So it became a thing. And honestly, it was because as a makeup artist, I just knew what was needed so women could find a blush that wouldn't look pasty on her. So it was really important to me.
And you said before that you were really a pioneer of teaching women to feel good about themselves. How was your approach different from what was already on the market, do you think?
Well, back then you'd go into a cosmetics department and someone would say, oh, would you like a makeover? Oh, let me show you how to make your eyes bigger. Let me show you how to make your nose smaller. And they would literally change the color of your skin. And it was like, guys, that doesn't make any sense. I have deep set eyes. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with it. And by the way, while I was growing the business, I was writing books. I was going on TV. So I became, you know, the communication out there to the world to talk about this philosophy, which was different than any other brand. And, you know, back then you'd go into, you know, you'd buy $300 worth of makeup and you'd come home with a chart where you wouldn't know what to do. There'd be arrows and all sorts of things. And I'm like, you know, makeup is so simple. If your foundation matches your skin, you don't need a how-to, you just put it on. If you're, you know, if you have a blush that is the color of your cheeks, then you don't need a how to apply it. So I'm a very simple person. You know, I don't know if people realize that, but I like to live my life simple and I like to teach people how to do things simply.
So selling your brand to Lauder, apart from financially, how else did that impact you?
Well, it allowed the business to grow. It allowed certainly me to do more things. You know, the activations internationally and global and the traveling and, you know, the very large budgets to be able to, you know, stay in the nicest hotels and the biggest suites and attend all these fabulous things and fashion weeks. And I don't know if I would have, if I had my own business, if I would have done those things. So, you know, it was there was definitely a lot of perks back then.
So it must have really changed your life hugely.
Oh, it did. It absolutely did. You know, there's no question. And, you know, I look back, I stayed 22 years. So I was an employee for 22 years. And I would say 18 glorious years, 20, you know, doable years and two really tough years.
Right. And so that brings us on nicely. Thank you for that segue. Onto your point number five, which is leaving the brand in 2016. So you just mentioned two tough years. What was happening in the tough years?
Well, you know, the business certainly grew. When I left the brand, it was $1 billion, which, you know, if I could find my math teacher in fourth grade that, you know, gave me D's, I'd be like, ha ha, Mrs. whatever your name was. But it was big and it was way over my head. And honestly, I used to travel the globe and be so frustrated by the things I saw. Like I would see things that needed to be fixed and I couldn't get anyone to fix them. And actually, when I left the company, I had all of these photos stored of things that needed to be fixed. I just deleted the whole thing. It was the most cathartic, wonderful. You know, I'm also, besides being simple, I'm really naive. Like, I don't think something's not going to work out. And I honestly thought I could fix the problems. You know, I did. That's why I stayed for two extra years. I just thought, you know what? Eventually, we're going to get the right leadership. Eventually, I'm going to have this. And I just never did. So, you know, it was my 89-year-old Aunt Alice that said to me, I can't keep hearing you complain. Oh, it's not going to get better. I think it's time. I was 59 years old, had no clue what I was going to do. I happened to have had, luckily, a project, which was my ninth book, Beauty from the Inside Out, which I needed to go promote the following April. So, you know, I first had a lot of, you know, PR activation talking about leaving the brand and, you know, a lot of amazing support from editors and women about what I actually did. But I can't believe people still don't realize I am not with the brand. It's been 4 years, you know, which is crazy. But so I started working in health and wellness and I went back to school. I got my degree as a health coach. A friend of mine offered a retail opportunity to start the Just Bobby shops. We were in 4 to 6 different department stores, and I got to curate all this great things that I loved and work with creative teams. So that kept me busy. Mm-hmm. And slowly I just started this new company, which I call a lifestyle company, which is everything from a hotel to a photo studio to now the wellness brand. And, you know, I somehow transitioned.
And did you feel any kind of sadness at leaving behind, you know, your name at that company?
I left with so many emotions. I left with sadness. I left with anger. I left with frustration. I left with a lot of emotional things. I worked really hard on myself to kind of go through this tunnel and get rid of all those feelings, you know? And of course, there's, you know, the worst emotion of all is anger. And whatever anger I felt, or, you know, some of the people that I thought were my friends were not. And, you know, it took a while for me to get rid of that. And now I look at the company and I'm like, I wish them well. It's not the company I created. It's not what I would have done. And I'm not part of it anymore. Right. And I'm fine with that. I just want to shout it so people understand it. I did not make that, and I did not do that campaign.
Right. That must be so hard though. Like seeing that stuff, you know, happening and you're not part of it, and thinking people think you're connected with it. I mean, yeah, that must be difficult.
I'm really proud of what I've done. I'm proud of the careers I've given to all of my makeup artists. I'm proud of, you know, what I've helped women do. And by the way, this whole journey, I did get to send, you know, 20 something people to college. I couldn't have done that without, you know, Estee Lauder. So.
And it's a similar kind of story to Jo Malone, actually, isn't it? I know that you talked to her when you left because she'd kind of been through a similar experience. Did she give you some good advice?
You know what? It's very interesting. You know, one of the things that I've noticed since I left the brand is my relationships with other women have strengthened so much. And I, you know, this movement of empowerment that I've always felt and believed in is just like this groundswell that I love being part of. So yes, Jo Malone, Marcia Kilgore, you know, so many women who have somehow founded these incredible companies, left the company, started new ones. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, a great respect for these, you know, the sisters, and they are there if I need them. And yes.
So let's move on to moment 6, which is your final one, which is reinvigorating your entrepreneurial roots with Beauty Evolution.
Right.
So tell us about Beauty Evolution.
Beauty Evolution is a lifestyle brand that encompasses everything about how you live your life. And my platform and my journey to teach women and men how to be healthier, how to feel better in your body, and how to constantly strive for better things, which is what I believe in.
Did you recognize that you had entrepreneurial spirit before you started Bobbi Brown Essentials? Did you know you had it, or did it just kind of come out?
Well, I think I knew I had it. I didn't really, you know, walk around saying I'm an entrepreneur, because no one did back then. I mean, I ended up, you know, when I was in 7th grade, my friends and I made a store that sold jewelry in my basement, which, you know, We did have investors, and that was our parents, and we did not have any foot traffic, so we didn't have a lot of sales, but it was fun creating it.
Right.
So I, you know, yes, I guess I didn't know that I was an entrepreneur. I just knew I made shit up.
Right.
I made shit up. I just, and I wasn't like anyone else. And I always thought I wasn't as smart as other people, but now I know that there's creative people that do things differently. You know, like I had an aha moment. I've written 9 books. By the way, I don't know how to type. Okay. I've written 9 books. So I finally, like, I think my fourth book, I said to the publisher, let me just photograph it first and then I'll write it afterwards. And she's like, what are you talking about? I said, let me show you. So that's what I do with my books. I go in the studio, I shoot them, and then I have my writer kind of piece the book together. Makes no sense, but it makes sense to me.
So a lot of women, I just read this week, that a lot of women are thinking about starting their own businesses as a kind of response to the pandemic and what's happened to them at home and work and etc. What advice would you give to women who are thinking about starting their own thing?
Well, first of all, to do it, you know, to do it and just do it smart. But to do it smart means don't take all your savings. Don't spend money where you don't have to. Don't give up your job if you need to pay your mortgage or your rent. And start doing almost as a hobby or a side hustle, whatever this new thing is. Unless, you know, it's, you can't give blanket advice to women because you never know what they're going through, what their financial situation is. So I'm not saying, ladies, everyone leave your job and, you know, start your granola company. But if you are going to start a granola company or a protein cookie or whatever you decide to make, how is it better than anything else out there? How realistic is it to make it? And then where would you sell it? And right now there's so much, I look out there and yes, the retail is not good. I don't know when it will come back. You know, direct to consumer is everything, but you just have to kind of be clever and go slow. There's no rush.
Right. That is a good lesson. I like what you said about the side hustle, because everybody thinks, oh, I'm going to have to give up my job and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But actually you're saying slowly maybe start something on the side.
And see where the holes are. Like maybe no one is doing something, you know, start a digital, I don't know, if you're really good at like bookkeeping and you're tired of going into that job, start a digital, you know, consulting company. There's things you could do.
Yeah. And I read that you said that the best business lesson you've learned is don't ask anyone if you should do something. Is that, do you still stand by that?
Well, I think I probably said, you know, don't ask for permission, beg for forgiveness. But no, it's actually the opposite of what you said. I do think that when you are doing something, ask people's opinion. It's up to you if you want to listen. It's up to you if you want to listen. Right. Yes, you need people's opinion. You know, I've helped a woman that was making these dog snacks and she's selling them out of her house and she's, you know, whatever, whatever. And I said, are people reordering them? And she said, some. And I said, did you, like, you know, do you know if people like them? And she, you know, dog owner, she says, well, I don't. I said, well, why don't you go to the dog park and bring some and give them out and see what the, you know, see what they're saying. And then, by the way, when you see them again, if they like it, tell them to post it. like just keep doing those. You have to know that what you're doing is worth it.
So I'm going to ask you a final question, which I've been asking everyone, which is thinking about moments. If you have to think of a happy moment from your life, one that's just a moment of pure joy and happiness, what comes to mind?
I am on a vacation. I am in the Bahamas. We have a home there. Mm-hmm. And I am with my three children, their fiancés, my nephews, my dogs, and we are just having dinner outside where someone's cooking for us and having a cocktail. There's always a breeze because I hate being hot. There's always a lovely breeze and a cotton sweater involved. I am, that is pure joy for me.
That is so nice. It's so funny that everyone I've asked, I think probably apart from maybe one person, has said being with their family. It's interesting that it's like not having dinner with Jean-Paul Gaultier, probably. Although I'm sure that would be nice.
It was lovely. And I have had dinner with Mick Jagger at his house. And that was lovely. And luckily I had nothing, you know, my kids' school didn't call me.
That's So, yeah, he's got a temperature. You need to come home. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, Bobbi Brown, thank you so much for your time and for giving us your 6 moments. They were awesome. Thank you.
You are welcome. And thank you for doing the work you do.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind, and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.